Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm your host, Willem Vanderhorst. For those who don't know or not familiar with the show yet, I'm a marketing and brand strategist. In short, I help brands or in large companies figure out how best to communicate with their audiences. And in this show, I have conversations and kind of like in-depth interviews with professionals in a wide variety of fields, most often either revolving around marketing and advertising, media, and the other side of it, which is game design and gaming. So some of my favorite topics, basically. I love games and I work in advertising and marketing, and I'm always exploring what's going on in the cross section of both. What can I learn from both those universes to put them together somehow? What else is going on this week? Last week, I started going to mentor at the School of Communication Arts in London, Brixton, to mentor students. And I can't believe I didn't know about it. I went to a conference and heard Mark Lewis speak, the person who founded the school. And it's a really amazing project. It's very, very cool. It's really nice to go and talk to students and ask them questions and give them some feedback on their portfolios and ask them work through the briefs they're doing. And they're always working on a wide variety of super interesting brief without any constraints from clients, etc. So it's really nice. So I'll be looking forward to going again soon. I'll add the link in the show note. If you work in London and you work in advertising, I recommend checking it out. There might be opportunities to mentor, and if there are, I recommend jumping in because it's really worth it. On to this episode. So as usual, but don't forget, if you enjoy the podcast, it would be awesome if you take a moment to post a rating or review wherever it is you're listening to this. Ideally, so posting a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher also, you can give it a thumbs up, but iTunes is generally the biggest place where people find and listen to podcasts. And you can also check out and find more content on the main website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. And there you can find my blog. You can also sign up to the Ice Cream Sunday long-form newsletter that I'd love to have more feedback from. So if you read, I'd love to have some feedback. Now, moving on. Our guest today is Tom Williams, the founder of the gaming and events company called A Door in a Wall in London. They organize live murder mystery treasure hunts events in and around London, and you can book them for private events like a company, stag do or hen do, for example. So they organize, and they recently just launched their first monthly game. So usually they organize events that run over the course of 1-2 months or so, and 3-4 times a year for large groups of people. And now they've started running a regular event monthly called Revealed Threat. We'll be talking about that during the episode, but we'll be talking about his inspiration, where he's from, his art studies, what got him into this idea of doing murder mystery events and treasure hunts. How is it different from the new trend of escape rooms with puzzles in, where you're supposed to come out of the room? One more thing before we go on to the show. This recording, I have to apologize. I'm really sorry. There's regular noises throughout. It was the first time I recorded in my new living room, where I moved to recently, and I realized only after the fact that there were noises that I couldn't hear while we were talking. And there was also a cat regularly trying to wander onto the table where the mic was. So I think overall it shouldn't be too bothersome, but I'm really sorry if it is. I watch out and create a better recording environment next time. I'm still learning about the different areas of the house. But yeah, I'll do better next time, so apologies for that. Now, without further ado, Tom Williams. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming around and coming down to meet me in person as well. I really appreciate that. It's cool.
No, it's fantastic. Thank you very much for having me along.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to this, particularly that, and I think I told you when we caught up last week, and I've been following a little bit of A Door in a Wall for a little while, but I still haven't actually participated to an event. So I'm looking forward to finding out more about it in preparation for participating to one of them.
Yeah, it's funny. It takes me always a little while to explain what it is and how it works, but there really is no substitute for seeing it happen live right in front of you. It is very much a live event.
Yeah, cool. Before we jump into it, and fortunately we do have a little bit of time so that we can go over all the details about it, but I usually start with a kind of warm-up question, and I was hesitating between two as I was doing some preparation. Okay. But one of my main destinations for stalking the people I'm going to be interviewing and find out, you know, about their history is LinkedIn. But I couldn't find a profile for you, and you didn't seem to have a lot of other
social media stuff, not that much, a little bit here and there. But do you, and maybe, but I don't know if it's a name thing, or do you not have a LinkedIn account?
I don't know. No.
Yeah, all right. So it's not just, all right. So is there any particular reason or?
Probably laziness. it's one of those things that seem to pass me by, and actually now it probably would be useful, but it's never, I think most people often do it because they think, oh, I'm looking for a new job. I better set up one of those profiles and things. And I had, before I did Door in a Wall, I had, I used to work in the city. So, but I was kind of in the same job for quite a while. And so it didn't really matter.
There's no particular point to it, yeah.
Yeah, the emphasis was less. And I think at the time I was sort of, I don't need any of this stupid Facebook for corporate whatevers. Right. But actually, I use it more and more in terms of like looking people up. You say it's so useful for that. So I should probably belatedly get a ticket for that train.
Got it. And going back to the, where are you from?
I'm from London.
Are you?
Yeah, okay. it's really actually quite rare and surprising. We're walking around in London. Where are you from? Oh, you're actually from the
I
place
know,
that
so
we're
it's so funny.
In.
I'm noticing my own surprises that, oh, really? You come from London? That's weird. Like, no, nobody comes from London in London anymore.
No, it's a temporary town. Indeed, it was for me because I grew up in London. I was here till I was like 12, 13, something like that.
So whereabouts?
West London, Acton.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of leafy, suburby. It's these days, I think, because London changes so much. I think these days Acton is little Poland. I think they've got all the all the better for it. Yeah, it was sort of a bit dull before, and now they've got some sort of shops with interesting sausages in the window and things.
Okay. So all the smoke products over there.
There till I was about 12 or something, and then my dad moved away to the Middle East, and family went with him. So I was out at an international school in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates for a couple of years.
How was that?
That was an incredible culture shock. Although when you're that age, when you're 12 or something, you don't sort of
realize that.
Yeah, you don't realize. You know, oh, we're going off to this different place and it's going to be really different. And it was really different.
Yeah.
But not that different because, you know, there's still McDonald's on this corner, you know,
right.
Things like that.
Yeah.
But to be there at that time and see it change then over the subsequent decade. We think London changes a lot, but the scale of change in that decade that I was out in the United Arab Emirates, both in Abu Dhabi and in neighboring Dubai, which is an hour and a half down the road, you know,
right.
It's they're very close. It was phenomenal. The way that these places completely remade themselves, and we'd missed all the early stages of it. You know, by then they were well established, but it was when we went out there, you would say to people, oh, so where are you going again? You go Abu Dhabi. They go, where's that?
Yeah.
And when we came back, it was, oh, have you seen these things in Abu Dhabi? It was, everybody knew.
Yeah,
where
they got onto
the
global, world stage, right? Nobody really knew the names before.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was. Very interesting being
there. So you lived there for 10 years?
The family lived there for 10 years, more than 10 years, sort of hopping between there and Qatar as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was there in international school for 2 years, so I lived out there permanently for 2 years.
Okay.
And then I was at boarding school in the UK.
Okay.
And then subsequently university, so I was kind of back and forth. So I sort of visited it sort of.
Where'd you go to boarding school?
A school called Sherburn in the West Country. Down in Dorset.
Nice.
Again, very, very green, very little, tiny, picturesque country town in England. I had a really great time there.
Yeah.
It's hard not to when you've got the facilities that kind of school has. But it's, and I can't say I came away from there with sort of really strong connection. I don't see many people that I went to school with, for example, but I always do look back on it very fondly. Like there was so much to do, and it was such a.
Do you have any particular favorite topics, activities, or either activities or things to study? Topics?
Arts.
Okay.
I had to deliberately push myself to do it because I was more of an academic leaning. So sort of all my sort of teachers and probably my parents as well, were all like, no, you've got to do maths and maths and more maths and physics and chemistry and economics. And I did most of those things.
Yeah.
But I was always determined I really wanted to keep a place for for art as well. And the art school down there was fantastic. It was this building that it was all off by itself at the top end of the school. So you really had to kind of schlep out there to get it. And it was run by this sort of band of crazy eccentrics who were hated by the rest of the teachers. So it was kind of, it was a bit of a place for the,
Do you remember one teacher in particular or how they...
Oh, yeah. This guy, Trevor Boyd, who was the head of art at the time. And he was this sort of squat, rotund, red-faced man with this crazy hair all over the place and a bristling toothbrush moustache. And he would just storm into the room in the middle of a lesson and go, you, what are you doing? Show me. No, do it like this, and grab the charcoal out of their hand and twists it and turns it. Look at that, see, marks, you've got to make marks on the paper, and then just walk out the room again.
Brilliant.
He was quite a character, and it took me, I think, all of my time to understand his mannerisms and but what you would think he was a fool initially, but there was a lot going on there, and he had the good sense to keep an incredibly well stocked art library, which very few schools, even schools that have the kind of money to throw around that someone like Sherbin does, would invest in.
Yeah.
They would think, oh, you know, let's build a dark room or a print studio or a ceramic studio, you know, if we have this kind of money to do more things. And they did have some of those things, but he was always very adamant that he wanted to keep a really separate art library. As art students, it was very frustrating for us because we wanted to go and do practical things. We wanted to draw. We wanted to paint. He'd say, no, you're going to go and sit in the library. You're going to just pick a book, any book. You can sit and read it. And it seeps in the understanding of what people have done before and the ideas of everybody that's ever, you know, because you think... you're a teenager and you're touching a brush to a canvas and you think you're the first person that's ever done it. It really helps to have an understanding of what's come before. Mm. And so that when you do something, you're doing it not just because it's what your gut tells you to do, although that's not completely valueless, but it's because you have an appreciation of what that means and how it can relate to everything else that you do.
And did you have do you remember a particular either artist or book that was influential for you that you appreciated or remember that library?
We grabbed the things from all over. I always particularly responded to, I was always fascinated by Andy Warhol in terms of his, even not so much the art he produced, because it's a bit of a cliche, but people can say, you know, Andy Warhol's greatest artwork was Andy Warhol. You know, he was this sort of crazy, enigmatic character who really toyed with and frustrated the sort of sensibilities of a lot of people's ideas of what an artist should be and how they should present themselves. And it was someone who, instead of kind of trying to ignore the modern world or look somewhere else for inspiration, really embraced the culture that he found all around himself. And I really like that idea of working with what you have, not trying to sort of create something else, some other.
So what was your particular, were you like painting and drawing a lot or some other forms?
Did silkscreen prints. And that was really interesting because that combines, we did a lot of digital image manipulation with that before it kind of goes into the physical thing where you sort of have to lay out your layers on Photoshop. It's not particularly complicated by today's standards, but you then transfer all each sort of layer individually to a silk screen quite literally, and you score the ink across it. So then it sort of builds up an image sort of color by color, layer by layer.
Cool.
It's a very satisfying process doing that, because you are doing something physical, but it's kind of instant as well. You sort of work on the image and manipulate it digitally and then lay it out, and then shoom, one stroke of the thing and all the ink's there. But we also did, they encouraged us to do lots of different media, so did photography, did some painting, I don't think I was ever great at
painting, although who knows when you work at these things. I did always like, and it's one thing I lament I don't do anymore. I always used to enjoy keeping a sketchbook and just doing little sketches, and it's very satisfying. That is something that really, people say, oh, I can draw, I can't draw. That is really a function of how much you do it.
Yeah.
You know, you sketch a lot, you will do some good sketches.
Yeah.
You don't keep it up, they'll look terrible. And it makes it hard to pick it up again, because then you sort of, you pick it up, you do a few, and you don't think they're very good because they're the first, you've done 10 after not having done any for 3 years.
Yeah.
And they don't look so good. But if you stick at it, and I know this, like if I wanted to pick it up, I could do, but it'd be, you have to invest the time in it.
Yeah, of course. And did you play games, or was there any of the burgeoning stuff that you do now with the door and the wall? Are you puzzles?
Yeah, I used to play. I don't know whether this is a sort of bit of a. It has such a sort of stigma around it. I used to play the little miniatures games, the war games, the Warhammer things.
By the way, in this podcast, I interview tabletop gamers, and there's a lot of people playing role-playing games, miniatures, board games, so there's no...
Well, no, I know.
It's a geeky podcast.
It's weird, because it has had this sort of renaissance now. It does, and even now, I see people posting about it and writing about it. Because I did all that stuff when I was a kid, I sort of have... I can still, you know, you still have those weird facts filed away of like... Right. Oh yeah, I used to do that thing, and this is this many points, and that does that, and this has initiatives number 7 or something. You know, you kind of vaguely kind of recall these little details.
Do you remember what did you play in Warhammer?
I played Warhammer.
Like more the World War II type war games, or
I played Warhammer originally, and then, but I always had a, because I was sort of playing, I played with a very small group of people. I didn't sort of go out into the world with it and play. I played with a few close friends and my brothers.
Yeah.
And so we would inevitably end up adapting things quite a lot. So, sure. You know, we'd house rule things, or we'd create whole versions of like a new game. You know, we just wanted to do something smaller, and we'd say, okay, maybe we'll play it like this instead.
It's often part of the pleasure to hack it in, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Really pleasurable. And I remember I kept up with that hobby sort of off and on for quite a while. The... One thing I do really remember about it, because I also picked up Games Workshop, the company that made Warhammer, also did a game called Epic 40,000, which was the sort of really small scale miniatures for the Warhammer 40K universe. So they had, it allowed you basically to have like these whole sort of squadrons of tanks instead of like one tank.
Right.
And it never really took off. I don't think it was ever very sort of commercially successful for them, because it doesn't have the same. Because the miniatures aren't as detailed, because you're scaling them down, so you know they're an inch long. You know, a tank is an inch, and a man is 3 mil high or something. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have the same sort of visual spectacle, or you know, the miniatures aren't as fun, because you're sort of reducing everything down to such a small scale. But what I do remember about that was I looked at that game system, which was incredibly abstracted and incredibly simplified relative to the tiny, minute details of, you know, of Warhammer, where you've got like one guy and one guy fighting, and you go like, right, I've got to roll some dice to hit you, I've got to work out what they are now, okay, oh no, take the ones that hit you, have I actually done any damage, da, da, da. And it's from a game design perspective, I looked at that gun and that's madness, like it's so complicated for what is sort of what it's supposed to be. With Epic 40K, what I saw it there was an incredibly simplified system where you just go, right, these guys shooting at these guys, right, I need 6 dice, roll the dice, and it works.
Yeah, the cat's wandering around.
I saw something in that, and I thought, this is a great system. This allows you to play this huge sweeping battle, and it's really simple to pick up. You know, the rules were sort of, you know, the sort of summary sheet for the rules was like 2 sides of A5 or something. It was that easy. And I really, yeah, I remember really appreciating that at a time. Cool. Although I was kind of aware that like nobody bought it.
No, but it's good. It's really good to start seeing the value of like very simple systems and easy to pick up, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so what did you go on to study afterwards, like, you know, for, I guess, university?
So university, I studied economics. Okay. Economics and econometrics.
So based on the serious stuff that your parents kind of wanted to...
Based on the serious stuff my parents wanted me to do, but it was... I did the sort of mathsy, sciencey things at school, and then I was casting around for an extra A-level, as it was. And I thought, I'd never studied economics before in my life. I didn't have much of anything. I literally, but I saw it as an option. I knew I kind of liked the teacher that taught it. So I thought, oh, maybe I could do that. And I knew it was something a little bit more sophisticated. And you know, there were mathsy elements, so I played to my strength there. So I literally picked up a textbook and started reading it and thought, this is great. I want to study this. Yeah. And it was that easy. I said, yeah, okay, I'll do economics. And I loved it doing it at school and said, yeah, I just want to do more of this at university.
Do you know what it was about it that caught your interest?
It's hard to say. I can't remember. I remember is reading the book and going, this is really interesting. I think it was the way that it sought to simplify. Much as I like that simplification in the game systems, and economics obviously has very direct relationships to game theory. I really appreciated the trying to understand a very complex world by simplifying it. Mm-hmm. And the biggest criticism ever leveled to economics is that it simplifies things too much. And of course it does, because my God, the world is so infinitely complicated that you have to simplify it somehow to try and understand it. And it's that, it's not necessarily trying to reach absolute truth. It's trying to help us understand what goes on by making some abstractions, some simplifications to the world that we see to help us make sensible choices.
Cool. Actually, that's a really interesting point. Could you tell us a little bit about the links between, economics and game theory, and explain, the concept of game theory altogether, just quickly?
I mean, I only sort of touched on it very briefly in my university studies, but it's all about, game theory is about trying to determine what the best choices, very simply, and I'm probably getting it wrong. If anybody knows their game theory, this is willfully misrepresenting it. But ultimately, you're looking at a situation, looking at the possible outcomes, and saying, okay, what's the optimum result here? Yeah. How do we maximize the utility, to use their language, or the return, the reward to people that are taking part in this game, either from one sort of player's perspective or from all players' perspectives. Mm-hmm. And you can end up with some kind of odds outcomes here. You can set up these sort of very interesting situations. I mean, the most famous one is something like the Prisoner's Dilemma, where you've got two people in different rooms and they're trying to decide whether to trust one another or snitch on each other, and it's how do you make that decision? What are the inputs there, and how do people? You can look at it as an abstract in terms of, okay, assuming people are completely rational, how does the situation progress? What decisions are people likely to make? What's the likely outcome they're going to be? You can then compare it to a real world situation and go, okay, well, that's the abstract, and then we can see what happens in the real world, and then you're kind of wandering into the world of sort of experimental economics, behavioral economics, of looking at the differences between that abstract and that real, and going, well, how do people actually behave, and what can that tell us about people? Yeah. What inbuilt biases do people have? Which is fascinating, and is where a lot of the most interesting work in economics is.
Yeah. Do you enjoy, I know it's vulgarized, but Freakonomics and their podcast? I don't know if you listen or...
I do. I listen to a couple of their things. I've read the first two books that they put out. I prefer someone like Tim Harford.
Okay, I don't know him.
He's the undercover economist at the FT.
Okay, cool.
But he's also written a couple of books that are similar in approach, but they are a little less sensationalist.
Yeah.
I think it's very much a Freakonomics, you could tell, is that's written by Americans and Tim Harford is a Brit, and the tone perhaps appeals to me more, as it's my native language, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's clearly, Freakonomics has been built to be a bestseller, you know, the clickbaity kind of titles and the topics as well, of course.
Yeah, and often it can sort of get caught up in the context, and then the sort of the theory can sometimes be a little bit lagging behind. But there's not to deny it, it's very, very interesting. I really enjoyed reading those two books. Cool. But yeah, I would recommend Tim Harford for Popular Economics.
Got it. And so did you go straight out of university to the city or...?
I did, yeah. This was
Working in finance of some kind.
Yeah, I did 2 years working for a small firm as a financial advisor, and then I moved to Aviva, the investment arm of Aviva Investors, and I did 6 years there as I did like all kinds of different things while I was there, but I ended up as a sort of technical specialist, but still a sort of salesman. So I would be the technical, the salespeople would come in and talk nonsense for half an hour and just shake people's hands and say nice things. And then they'd work out what this person was interested in. And if it happened to be emerging market debt, which is what I was based around, they'd call me into the room and I'd tell them how great we were at emerging market debt and talk all the technicals.
Okay.
And I really liked working there. I had a really good time. But I think after 6 years, I was a bit... I was probably ready to move on to something else.
So is that when the treasure hunting started brewing or was that was already there.
It was kind of bubbling along in the background. It was
so
something
how did that start?
So that started out, the sort of first seeds of it was something I did at university. Mm-hmm. We had this, this odd sort of fallow period between finishing exams and getting results. Yeah. We sort of had like a week and a half or whatever where we literally had nothing to do. We were all around in Nottingham, just either just going out and partying every night or you know, sitting around playing PlayStation or whatever we were doing. It was really pointless time. We could have made better use of it. But what I ended up doing for one of the days was we made a fun little treasure hunt around Nottingham city centre just for some friends and set up some clues and things around.
So were you the instigator of that?
Yeah.
Out of nowhere, just like because you were bored and started...
Yeah, literally because we were bored. And
see, this is what comes out of idle time.
Yeah, there we go. but it was... And it was... Yeah, everybody just had a really good time and it just... struck everyone that helped run it or the player. You know, this was not a big thing.
So this was hiding clues. Did people have, what did they have, an instruction book or map or what did you...
No, I think it was a treasure hunt in its very simplest form. There was, it was mostly observational stuff, but it was following a sequence of clues to get to a secret final location. I think there were like 7 clues. You know, it took people an hour and a half or whatever.
Yeah.
To get there, and you know, we maybe had, this was not a big thing at all, like 5 or 6 teams of people doing it.
Yeah.
And we all just we met in the pub at the end, and somebody got a bottle of champagne to say well done for winning, and then we just and everyone had some drinks and chatted about how fun it had been.
Brilliant.
But it was very, very, very simple.
Yeah.
In treasure hunt terms. And then after that fun incident, I basically did nothing with it for like 2 years. But that always sort of did stick in my mind as, hey, that was something fun.
Mm.
Maybe should do it again someday. And once in London, myself and my flatmate at the time sort of resurrected the idea then and said, oh, you know, we've got someone's birthday coming up. Let's do an elaborate treasure hunt for it. You know, that's so fun. It got people together.
Yeah.
And you know, we did a couple of those. Again, it's very observational, or you know, you had to go and take a photo of yourself doing this, or see how many of these you can find. It's what seems to me very sort of staid and uninteresting.
And in the beginning, while you were setting those up, did you do some research or some reading about how other treasure hunts are done? You just went with, you know, whatever you knew.
No, we did nothing. We just went, what's going to be the most fun thing that we can think of right now?
Okay, cool.
And we went out and did it. And they were great fun. And people, we did a couple of those. First one, a bit out of the blue, and people came along and had a good time. So that when we did the second one, suddenly we had like 150 people come along because everybody was so stoked about it. And then that
was purely just like word of mouth, friends of friends talking about it.
Yeah.
And but so 150 people, but like at one time, or did you organize runs of like smaller groups after one after the other? How does
we
it work?
Gave everybody like a big list of stuff to do, and we really we put so much stuff in there. It was we spent like weeks sort of finding all of the stuff and putting it into these big things and saying, all right, you just do as much of this as you can, and sort of whoever does the most of it within, you know, the afternoon gets, you know, gets the points.
Okay.
And it was. It was a nightmare to mark all of that at the end. I mean, I don't think we had any fun at the party, because we spent like 3 hours like trying to mark all this stuff for people. It was difficult, but the point was that it was quite successful. Yeah. And then I sort of went away and again sat on it for, you know, a year. Probably didn't do anything else. You know, we had day jobs, we had stuff. Yeah. Life got in the way.
Sure,
but the. I was always thinking about how can you take this format and do something more amazing with it, something more interesting. At the time, a lot of us used to go to a place called the Shunt Lounge underneath London Bridge Station.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, I remember.
And that was such a sort of formative experience for me, sort of going through this literal door in a wall into this club, which wasn't like any other club I'd ever been in. You walk through this door and there could be anything in there. Like it could be very little. It could be some really minimalist art installations. They had these huge cavernous tunnels that seemed to go on forever underneath the station, and the door's like in the station.
Yeah.
You had to go into the station through this tiny door. You'd get ticked off and who knows what would have been around.
Weren't one of the first punch drunk installations over there, around there, or behind the station?
You know? I'm sure they would have been. Yeah, they would have been people who had done things there.
Mm.
There's a lot of really interesting artists and makers out there today who are doing interesting things. Who did some of their first stuff in the Shunt Lounge. I never put anything together there, but I was there as a punter an awful lot, and it was fantastic. That sense of wonder and amazement and discovery and just sort of serendipitous joy at sort of discovering something bizarre and unexpected and new and exciting and often engaging, often interactive. You know, it wasn't something where you just... sometimes, you know, it was just visual stuff that you'd go in and have a look around. But some, more often than not, it was something that you were involved in. It was a little show with audience participation, or they'd set up... I remember once they turned it into the People's Republic of Shunt, and they had giant banners of the glorious leader everywhere, and you had to learn the national salute and sing the silly anthem, and there was a sort of spy game with phone boxes and people dragging you off into surreal interrogations.
Wow.
It was just... phenomenal, bizarre, and incredible amount of fun.
So that was a bunch of inspiration that came from there, or
totally. That was something that sort of gave continues to give me ideas.
Yeah.
For how to take a treasure hunt format and make it into a journey where you discover and interact with and find incredible things along the way.
So integrating, so my understanding is most of the door in a wall events are, so it's kind of a treasure hunt, but it's also integrating a lot of elements from murder mysteries.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So one of the three things that, I always say, like, door in a wall events have three sort of key things about them. One is they're live events that happen in the real world.
Yeah.
So these real world locations. They are always designed as games.
Okay.
So they're interactive.
Yeah.
And they're not, as opposed to something that's just observational that you are a spectator.
Such as a punch drunk event, for example.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
Which is, well, you're part of a whole thing, but you're more observing what's going on, from what I understand.
Yeah. They tend to be set up that way. Although, from what I hear, punch drunk have got some leanings towards more interactive things as well. But it's important to note there is a great deal of interactivity within a Punch Drunk show. even though most of the time you're a spectator sort of observing the cast do their thing, and the cast don't really acknowledge you most of the time, you're able to interact with the environment a great deal.
Yes, that is true. Yeah.
You can open the drawers and there will be things inside there. The level of detail they go to is phenomenal.
I've heard, it's like a couple of friends went to the semi-permanent or permanent one they have going on in New York right now.
Sleep No More.
Yes, yep. That's right. Apparently it's really amazing. I've heard amazing things about it. I'd love to go to one of their shows. I haven't been to any, actually.
I've only been to The Drowned Man, their most recent one in London. I sadly missed The Mask of the Red Death. Some of my friends went and said, it's the best thing they've ever done.
Mm.
But I mean, they are very much sort of the gold standard in terms of set design and immersive environments.
Yeah.
So we try to take the interactivity to the next level because we're designing a game and not a theatre piece.
Yes,
we are putting our players as protagonists and as the people that are making the decisions. Again, in sort of game designing, they have agency. They choose where they go. They choose what they see. They choose what they say. They choose how to interpret the things that they find.
Mm.
And
where did the choice come from to integrate the gaming element inside of it? Was there a shift in the way that you envisioned how you're planning your events to move from a treasure hunt to a game?
It was always how to evolve a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
How to move a treasure hunt away from walking around looking at blue plaques.
Yeah.
To make a treasure hunt more interactive, and the final element of the sort of door in a wall game that gives it the extra impetus or makes it more exciting is the addition of narrative.
Yes.
So real world location, interactivity, and a narrative, and putting a story behind a treasure hunt gives you a lot more of a driver to see things and gives you a context to see them in.
Mm.
This isn't just a thing which is interesting because it's interesting, it's so right. It's a thing that's interesting and therefore could be a mundane thing, but is therefore interesting because it has a bearing on the story that you're involved in.
Yeah.
And it means something.
And how about, so are the puns, like you have an amazing amount of puns in all the names. That you, is that you?
It's a team effort with the puns.
Give us a couple of examples for the people who don't know, because I've been looking at them up. But
okay, so just in our most recent murder mystery, just the victim and suspect, for example, the victim was a celebrity chef called Amelia Love, and the three suspects were a restaurant critic called Marcus Pauly. A sous chef, Crispian Brown, and the self-absorbed brother-in-law, Saul Mee. So those are some. So every name in the game is normally a pun of some sort, and that includes all of the organizations and companies and things, all of the fictitious entities that exist within our storylines, and indeed get recycled and come back in future games. Oh, cool. So we have this sort of little. Almost unintentionally, we've created this little world of nonsense companies and people.
You got like this kind of branded trademark now that the silly puns that come with the door in a wall event.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have, and it means that when we need something in future, so we need a ridiculous bank, for example. So we've got the Banque Derrière is is a fictitious bank that we've worked with, or we have. Lawyers or estate agents or delivery companies. We've got a whole list of these things, and we pluck them out and write them into new stories, which is fun, and people do like the in-jokes when they come back.
Yeah.
So we have a strong returning crowd.
And one of the things about narrative that I really agree with, and it's part of the reason why I'm interested in these games, because escape rooms have started to be popular. There's a few in London, right, if I'm not mistaken?
Oh yeah.
I've tried one in Singapore once. I'm not amazing with the puzzles necessarily, but I thought what was missing out of that experience was the narrative experience. So it's very puzzly, obviously, but it just felt like the story was just slapped on top. It didn't really matter. You just like opening drawers and looking for the clues and looking for keys, which was cool in itself.
Mm.
But it feels like what you're doing is a whole level above that. Or I mean, I would say above, but you know what I mean. I don't know what you think of the difference between what you're doing in an escape room.
I do like to think that what we're doing is a more sophisticated version of that in some ways. But it's also important to note that we've got our events sort of take up a whole evening, a whole afternoon. We've got 3-4 hours to kind of to play with that and let that story sink in. Escape room, you've got an hour maximum.
Yeah.
So what story could be there has to be either very, very simple or not have a great deal of bearing on what you're doing.
Right.
But I do think you're right in that it's the trick that escape rooms miss is that they are very focused on puzzles and the sort of physical aspects of it, and the story often gets either slapped on top or it ends up just being a theme. You know, whether you're, you know, in a bank vault or you're in an Egyptian tomb or something, and it's sort of, it ends up being Crystal Maze in terms of its it's everything looks and feels like that, and the puzzles are inspired by that sort of visual aesthetic and the tropes associated with those mini genres. But there's no meaning to the story above that. The story doesn't inform what you're doing or how you're doing it. I went to one escape room and it was a brilliant escape room. It was actually the best escape room that I've done. The puzzles were fantastic. But it was very frustrating to see allusions to a story that ultimately meant nothing.
Right.
And that, you know, so you see, oh, there's a thing about this character here and there's something else about this character. What does it mean? Can I piece them together? It was just dressing. It didn't mean anything. And it was more about finding the key that unlocked the lock and doing the number puzzle and other things, which is fine. It's still fun.
Yeah.
But you are seeing some escape rooms moving more into a narrative-driven territory. I think the sort of most sophisticated escape room in London is probably Time Run.
Okay.
And they have a very detailed story and it's very, very immersive. Particularly in the way you go into the escape room and come out of the escape room, it's all sort of done in character, and it's all like right from the get-go. They sort of drop you into this world, and they do a very good job of that. It's also I think it's also one of the most expensive ones, and so that kind of comes at a price.
That, right? Yeah.
But there's other places that do sort of story-driven things as well, like Oubliette down in Brixton.
Okay.
Has a strong sort of theme to it. But yeah, I think escape rooms can do more with narrative.
And so where we're going with this, because so far, up to now, and that's one of the things that's changing, you've been organizing events several times a year, but they're like one-offs, and then you also organize private events, right?
That's right, we
do. And that's what allows you to, that's your full-time activity right now.
Yes, yeah. It's my full-time job as director. We do normally a couple of public shows a year, and they take the form of sort of long runs. So we design a new show, we run it for a few weeks, we sort of try and run it as much as we can during that period, but then it goes away, and then we start working on the next show.
Yeah. And you call them shows or games or events?
I call them all of those things. Okay. Usually depending on who I'm speaking to.
Yeah.
Usually try and squeeze in all three of those to kind of give it a sense of how it is. I use the word show in that context because it's in terms of understanding how we approach the repetition of it and the production of it. It has more in common with that regard with a theatre show.
Okay.
Where, you know, you have something written, you design it, rehearse it, and then you have an opening night and you run the same show every night for however many weeks you're doing it.
Yeah.
So what we're doing with those, we're sort of, those runs have gradually extended. I think the run we're planning for this May, June, and even into July is at least 7 weeks, which will be it's the longest run.
Is that a real threat, or is that
no? That's a new show we're going to announce at the end of this month.
We're not talking about that yet.
It's not secret. Okay. But the formal announcement of that will come at the end of this month. With some of the details, but that's our summer show, if you like.
Okay, so how about what show can you tell us about, just to give a bit of an example of the kind of narrative that people go through, players go through, either a previous show or an upcoming?
Well, I'll talk through. I could talk through our last big public show,
okay.
Which was An Appetite for Murder. The pun names, which you've already heard. that, again, sort of follows a format that we've iterated over a number of games. This is sort of, you can sort of trace the evolution of it right back to sort of those initial things I did when I first moved to London, in that, you know, we sort of added building block and changed the structure of it. And now we've got a format that works very, very well for us. And it generally operates as we have a central venue that players arrive at. There's normally a bar, people can get drinks, they can have something to eat, they get introduced to a murder mystery story.
Okay.
And we like murder mysteries because they have a very strong structure around them. Yeah. And people understand the parameters of how they operate, and they have a very clearly defined objective. Yeah. So we do like those.
And have the players are in groups, or how does
players take part in teams? Okay. We suggest 3 to 6 people, but you know, we're not hard and fast about it. If you want to play as a team of 2, it's fine. If you want to turn up and play as a team of 8, that's fine too.
And you have multiple teams working at the same time or playing at the same time?
Yeah, we have 50 people taking part in each event.
Okay.
And then they can divide themselves into teams as they wish. It normally works out that we have between 10, 11, 12 teams, something like that, taking part each time we run the game.
Okay.
So people arrive at a central venue, they're there for a little bit to give them time to sort of register and read the sort of starting information that we give people, which sets out the story, what yeah. people are trying to do, how they're going to play the game. And crucially, it also contains a load of leads to nearby locations where they can find out more information.
Okay.
So at a certain point, there's a sort of dramatic introduction. Normally sort of a couple of our actors involved in sort of setting the scene and setting players off to go and find out more about this awful deed. People then have 2 hours to explore the nearby streets. They start with the leads they have in the books, but those places will lead them to other places, Overall, we sort of usually aim for about 6 sort of trails of clues, which will normally take people kind of the full 2 hours or thereabouts to get around. So there is a bit of time pressure on this. Like, right, you've got 2 hours to try and get around all of these places. As people explore, as people discover more pieces of the puzzle, they gather, they visit places, they might find puzzles to do there, they might meet actor characters who are going to involve them in certain interactions, and these can be absolutely outlandish things unrelated to the plot, or they can be sort of more sensible things. We hire other spaces as well, so suddenly you can find yourself in a forger's den, or a backstreet surgery, or a footballer's flat, or any one of loads of different places. Or you never know what that actor character is going to suddenly get you to do.
Cool.
But as you go, as you solve those puzzles, as you find those locations, as you talk with those actors, you gradually discover more pieces of the story.
Yeah.
So that when you return to the central venue at the end of those 2 hours, you're presented with a load of questions that say, so tell us what happened. And you have to use all that evidence, tie it together, and work out, most importantly, sort of who done it.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, how they did it and what their motive was, and what the motive for the other people was, and why it wasn't that other person.
Yeah.
And then we take those in, a quick appraisal. And then there's a dramatic reveal where the in a sort of a Poirot-esque denouement, where the full story is laid out, and somebody wins a prize for being the best detective.
Brilliant.
The prizes are usually fairly token, but they are hotly contested nonetheless. People are very keen to come
get
away.
Into it, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we always say that it's more about having fun, and but yeah, people really want that trophy.
Awesome. And so when you started out, and still now, like, what are the kind of inspirations? Did you read any more about game designers that, like, mostly self-taught, or about, like, designing the stories, the puzzles?
I would say it's still mostly self-taught, but we make an effort with, because it's not just me that does it. This is a team of people that are involved. And we're always on the lookout for people to come into that team and add new expertise, be they game designers, be they artists, people with theatre background, and sort of being able to draw on all those sort of separate strands is incredibly useful to what we do, because I'm conscious that I've very much made it up as I go along.
Yeah.
And you know, my background isn't in, my professional background at least, isn't in those things. So being able to have a diverse cast of characters, even within our creative team, is very important.
Yeah, yeah.
To make sure we're drawing from the widest pool of ideas that we can.
And did you, were you into like crime novels or murder mysteries yourself, or is that like a genre you particularly like? Or
a bit, not so much. Not more than anyone else's, I don't think. I wasn't. I am more now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we picked it more because it's a story framework that works for us.
Yeah.
Less because we were all massive murder mystery geeks.
Sure.
But I think for the same reason that we sort of latched onto it, the same reason that everyone else could pick it up very easily, and that we were immediately familiar, despite not being murder mystery geeks, we were immediately familiar with the tropes of the genre.
Yeah.
And as to how and that everybody thing operates, is,
it's easy. Everybody can jump into it. Yeah. Everybody's seen at least or read one Agatha Christie or
one
procedural TV show.
Exactly. Or, you know. It's the same. It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
That comes out. So everybody's got an expectation of what that is and how that works. And so you don't have to invest all that time in getting them up to speed in terms of what they're actually doing.
Cool. All right, cool. Just conscious of time, I've got a few cool down questions.
Yeah.
And this is where I usually kind of mix up a few different of my interests or your interests possibly. Going through your Twitter timeline very quickly, are you into, because I'm into craft beers and I used to homebrew in Singapore as well. You're into your beers and ales a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so I'm testing a new ice cream question because this is, of course, the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. So I'm like trying different ice cream questions. If you made a beer into an ice cream, which beer style would you choose?
Oh, good question. I would go for something lighter.
Okay.
I think some of the sort of really citrusy IPAs.
Like an American IPA type thing?
Yeah, something where you've got, the sort of lemony.
Like grapefruit type thing.
That's what they were, a little bit tart.
One that you like? What American IPA do you particularly like?
Oh, gosh. See, here's where I'm going to like name something.
That's or a British one, but British like, one. You know, of course, I don't mean.
I really like the two breweries in particular that are doing a lot of great things. So I really like the Red Church Brewery.
Bethany Green. I don't know about them.
I think they've just put out. I think their new one is American leaning, and I really like almost everything they do. And actually, I've just moved house, and I literally live just across the street now from the Hamilton Brewery.
Okay, cool.
And their beer is excellent. They're sort of regular pale ale. Their N1 is fantastic, and their N7, which I think is their IPA, is also very good.
Cool. It's been an explosion of breweries in London in the past few years. Like, I left London in early 2011, and I was already into my beers. And The Rake in Borough Market was one of the only places to drink it. And since then, they're just, the explosion of it. Do you sometimes go to Maltby Street Market under the arches?
I was there last weekend, but actually for the first time in 2 years or something. But I have, all the breweries down there. You've got Anspach and Hobday, you've got Partisan and the Colonel.
Yeah.
There's a real sort of little crawl you can do down there. I think it's fantastic to see an industry that's so diverse and celebrates its creativity like that. There's so many people out there doing interesting things, and it's really paying dividends because they are making good beers that are gaining widespread appeal, to the point where, you go into almost any pub and there's probably going to be something interesting, probably on the tap, if not in the fridge.
Yeah, absolutely. Increasingly so. Another interest of mine, also because it's my job, right? I work in marketing and advertising. So I was interested in a couple of questions on how you promote and market the events for Adorn a Wall.
Yeah.
Is there any particular... Because it seems to be, from what I've read, like mostly word of mouth, right?
It is mostly word of mouth.
Yeah.
We have a very strong core following. Everything sort of goes out to our mailing list before it goes out to anyone else.
Okay.
And we have people that come back to our events time and time again, but that sort of grows gradually over time. People tell other people. We do use obviously social media to help promote it, although probably not as much as we should.
Mm.
The other thing that works for us, the only sort of paid promotion that we do is Facebook ads.
Oh, that works for you?
Yeah, it really does. Okay. They are very cost effective. Interesting. And the ability to do the...
Or to get people to events in particular, or...?
It's hard to trace it directly. We can do a little bit of analytics on it and see, you know, what the sort of click-throughs were and how people go through to sort of buying tickets and things. But ultimately, you don't have to spend a lot of money to get quite a lot of reach for those. Yeah. And it's...
Because you can really localize them.
You can really localize it. And also the A-B testing on it is very sophisticated and very valuable in that you can really iterate those adverts to be very successful and to have the most impact. It's very easy to teach yourself how to do that very quickly. So, you know, for a few £100, you can get ads that reach hundreds of thousands of people that are in the right place, that are doing the right thing, and you can see how successful it is immediately.
Do you think the success of that and the testing of the A-B testing is partly down to the fact that what you're doing is very localized geographically, so you're targeting people within London, or interest-based, so you may be targeting people interested in games or stories already? Or
we've tried both.
Yeah.
The geographical targeting is far more successful.
Got it.
It was like really markedly so. We thought, if we target interests, that's going to be really, where the response is going to come from, because we're going to see the sort of people that are already interested in things that we do. Compared to just a general London, the general ad is so much better.
Got it.
I don't fully understand why, but you know the numbers weren't lying. That was definitely a lot better. I think I like to think it's because our events have a very broad, immediate appeal. They're not promising, you know, the most sort of sophisticated chin-strokey, immersive, meaningful, powerful experience. They're designed to be fun. We're always about designing games and experiences that are fun and fun for everyone. So I like to think that the broader we make that appeal, the more response we'll get. And I also think that a lot of people that come to our events aren't people that would otherwise go to a lot of immersive theatre. Obviously we do get a lot of crossover, but I think people see them just as sort of fun.
Something different to do one night. And how about classic ads? You like one advert from TV that you find particularly that is memorable, something that you've remembered from whenever it was, childhood or teenage or recent, doesn't matter.
I saw something, I was thinking about this recently. What was it? Give me 30 seconds.
Something on the tip of your tongue.
I saw the other day and I thought, that's a really good ad. But I can't remember what it was.
What was it about?
Obviously it wasn't that good, because I can't remember it.
But it's always an interesting question, and it's a tough one, because sometimes people immediately go, I remember something, but sometimes...
I like the... there's a thing around... Innocent did a little pastiche of Apple Max ads.
Oh, did it? I didn't see that.
Well, yeah, it was sort of the latest in Apple technology, and obviously they do the Apple drinks, and it sort of mimic the style. I mean, it's not that clever, because it's obviously just riffing on somebody else's design, but it made me laugh. I also always like
Did you see the IKEA catalog one?
No.
They present the IKEA catalog as the latest kind of iPad, basically.
Right.
On a white background, they open it, they say, well, the user interface is amazing, and the battery power is infinite, and that kind of thing.
I like the... a friend of mine mentioned this and I the other day, and I agree with him, the Marmite ads of recognizing that some people hate your product.
That's brilliant.
Is always fine. I love Marmite, and my girlfriend hates it, so it has a very personal parallel for me. But that's always a lot.
That was strong. I agree with that. Cool. All right. Well, listen, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. So, where people want to find the Adore and a Wall, there's Adore and a Wall website.
AdoreandAWall.com. That's where everything's listed.
And the best is that, as you said, to get yourself onto the email list so you receive the news first, right?
Get on our mailing list. There's a little sign-up thing just on the front page at the bottom. That is the first place we always announce new things. We've got...
When's the new stuff coming out?
We'll news, let you...
New events soon, or?
Absolutely, we've got a new event, new announcements coming out in the next couple of days for the proper runs of A Veiled Threat, which
will already be announced by the time this is published.
Yeah, okay. that's our new monthly event, which will be running every month this year. Very, very exciting. And we've got our, as I said, our summer event running May, June, July. That will be announced around the end of March, with tickets going on sale a few days thereafter.
And also, you organize private events, so I guess for company dues and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Are designed from the ground up, so people can get in touch with you about that too, right?
They can. We've got a number of off-the-shelf things, and we can do bespoke events. Yeah. Sort of group sizes, 20, 30, 40 people, absolutely ideal.
As much for a company team building thing, or for a birthday, or... Yep. Stag do maybe?
Yeah,
we
do both. In fact, you know, I'm running one tomorrow for a company, one on Saturday for a birthday. Both things.
Cool, perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time.
No, it's been an
absolute
pleasure.
Looking forward to one of the next Door in the Wall events then.
Yeah, we'll gladly have you along.
Okay, that's another episode wrapping up. I hope you enjoyed listening to Tom. Of course, if you're listening to this from London, definitely get yourself over to a Door in a Wall event. Look up when the next Veil Threat is happening. It's happening every month. Thank you for listening. That's the main thing. I really hope you enjoyed it. I hope the noise wasn't too much of a disappointment, but I'll do better next time. And if you enjoyed it, how about sharing it with a friend? Just send them a link to the file. All I want is for more people to listen to this podcast. So if you think you know somebody who's interested in murder mysteries, interested in these kinds of live events, treasure hunts, just, you know, put it onto your social network or share it with them via email. If you have feedback, questions, comments, I always love to hear from you. I'll reply to every one of you. And you can contact me on Twitter. My username is @HippoWill. You can post a comment on the Ice Cream for Everyone Facebook page. That's Ice Cream for Everyone. Just look it up. Leave a review on iTunes would be amazing. That's so helpful. And you can always send me an email if you want to get in touch. That's Willem@icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything's spelled out still. And that's about it for now, I think. We've got a bunch more exciting episodes coming up. I've been recording a lot of different episodes. We've got some very exciting guests coming up for the next few weeks. So watch out for the next episode coming out, and have a great day or great night, great evening, whatever it is for you. All right, bye.